One Man Revolution. A guerrilla scholar warrior. A renaissance man for the new dark age. Welcome to Prof. CJ's Dangerous History Podcast.
Howdy, this is your humble hazardous history helmsman, Prof. CJ, and welcome to episode 52 of the Dangerous History Podcast. In this episode, I'm finally going to conclude, at least for now, who knows what'll happen down the road, but conclude for now, my multi-part series on a history of the U.S. dollar, and this will be part 5, the ticking time bomb of the petrodollar, looking at the U.S. dollar since the last tie to gold was severed with the end of the Bretton Woods system, and the closure of the so-called gold window by Richard Nixon. And by the way, if you notice the audio sounds a bit different than my last few episodes, that is because, yet again, I am recording from my car on my drive to work to go basically do the things that Socrates was executed for all those, you know, whatever it was, 2,400 years ago, something like that. Socrates, if you don't know, the first really well-known anyway, great Western philosopher, was sentenced to death by the Athenian government, and the charges against him were teaching impiety and corrupting the minds of the young, if I remember correctly. So, anyway, those are the things that probably are in my file somewhere in the deepest, darkest pits of one of the NSA surveillance facilities. And I guess that's what they'll justify it as when they finally drag me off to Guantanamo to be waterboarded and who the hell knows what else. But anyway, parts 1 through 4 of A History of the U.S. Dollar I did, and this has been a non-consecutive series the whole time, but it's been a really long time since the last one, part 4, and I was planning on doing this part 5 all along, but just never got around to it, kept getting distracted by other ideas for episodes that I wanted to do, kept saying, yeah, I'll get back to History of the Dollar. So anyway, today I finally am, and time, as is often the case for me when the semester's in full swing, is in short supply, so here I am in the car. You are, in a way, joining me on my commute. Perhaps I'm joining you on your commute as well, if you're one of my listeners who listens on their commute, or I'm joining you on your walk, your jog, your mowing the lawn, although this time of year, probably not too many places where you need to be mowing the lawn very much. Okay, so where we left off the story, if I remember correctly, was basically with the Nixon administration ending the Bretton Woods system. And I recommend, if you haven't listened to the previous episodes in this multi-part series, you really might want to do so before you listen to this one. And I will put in the show notes for this episode on my website, profcj.org, for episode 52, I will put some links in the show notes to those previous episodes on A History of the U.S. Dollar. And again, I recommend you listen to those if you have not already. And it's especially important to listen to the most recent one, part 4, talking about the rise and fall of the Bretton Woods system after World War II, in order to set the stage for the things I'm going to talk about this time. So, the U.S. government, with its partner in crime, the quasi-governmental fascist central bank known as the Federal Reserve, had been increasing the money supply ever more rapidly as the 1960s proceeded and into the early 1970s. And the main reason why there was so much monetary creation during those years was kind of three things happening at once, any one of which is enormously expensive and might push a government close to bankruptcy or even into it. And those three things are the Vietnam War, which was an extremely expensive war, the so-called War on Poverty, begun around 1964 or 65 with just scads of new federal welfare state programs, and then, of course, the space race and getting to the moon by the end of the decade, which also was extremely expensive. By the way, helped by those Nazis I mentioned a couple episodes back in Operation Paperclip. Well, taxes were, for the most part, raised little or none, at least at the federal level, during those years. So how do you pay for these ridiculously expensive things without raising people's taxes? Well, the answer is you do it through a combination of debt and inflation. And of course, debt requires inflation to keep servicing it and keep it ever expanding. You have to inflate. You can't just run up debt by itself for very long. So again, go back to the last episode I did on a history of the U.S. dollar, and you can get some more specifics on even a little bit of the numbers of what was happening as far as inflation, which culminated in the official end of the Bretton Woods system in 1972 by the Nixon administration, wherein the last tenuous link, and it was not a real gold standard, it was a phony gold standard, but the last tenuous link to the U.S. dollar, to gold, was severed. Basically, what had happened was that the United States government had created so much dollars that they were vastly in excess of the gold needed to back it up at the agreement of $35 an ounce made in the Bretton Woods Agreement at the end of World War II. And some other countries, including even some of our Western European fairly close allies, understood this. They were holding tons of dollars. You see, Bretton Woods had made the dollar the reserve currency of the world. And at the time, there were good reasons for it. One was that at the end of World War II, the United States was, by a huge margin, the world's number one manufacturing industrial country. In fact, it's been said that at the end of World War II, literally half of all industrial manufacturing on planet Earth was conducted by the United States, inside the United States. Okay, so far cry from recent times, as far as that goes. So that was one reason why it made sense for the U.S. dollar to become the world's reserve currency after World War II. The other reason was they, in the Bretton Woods Agreement, the United States government promised to back it with gold at $35 an ounce, which, you know, provided another reason. At the time, it was, as far as I know, the only major world currency, perhaps the only world currency at all, for all I know, to even have any official guaranteed backing with gold. Now, of course, it was a phony gold standard in that any regular average Joe with $35 of paper in their pocket couldn't walk down to a bank and exchange it for an ounce of gold, as you can under a true gold standard. Instead, it was only supposed to be foreign banks, and I think it was even foreign central banks specifically, not even just average foreign banks, that could exchange for gold on demand. And what happened was, countries, when in the late 60s, early 70s, they realized that the U.S. government was really going nuts with money printing, they didn't want to be left holding the bag. They understood there would have to be a devaluation sooner or later. You can delay the consequences of the laws of economics, but you cannot avoid them. And furthermore, when you delay the consequences of the laws of economics, you simply make those consequences that will eventually hit down the road larger and more severe. So various countries start changing in their paper dollars for gold so much that there was a massive outflow of gold from the United States, and this is what caused Richard Nixon, rather than getting government spending and money creation and debt creation, rather than getting that under control and imposing fiscal restraint, the quote-unquote solution was just renege on the Bretton Woods promises and stop guaranteeing dollars with gold, stop offering the exchange of paper dollars for gold by foreign central banks. So that's that. And of course, this may have stopped the outflow of gold bullion from the United States, but it did not stop the fall in value of the dollar, the monetary inflation, the price inflation, from continuing. In fact, it only accelerated after the end of Bretton Woods. Now, high inflation causes lots of problems in society. It is, in my opinion, in the opinion of many economists far more brilliant and knowledgeable than I am, it is arguably the most destructive economic phenomenon on a society, on sort of its stability, its tranquility, its prosperity, the sort of fairness of society, all these things. High inflation is actually worse than just a regular run-of-the-mill depression. Because in a regular run-of-the-mill depression, you may lose your job, or if you own a business, your business may decline sharply. But if you figure out a way to get some money, you can still buy stuff. And in fact, in a depression where there's been no government inflation, prices will actually tend to naturally fall. And so for people who, you know, keep their job or lose their job but find a new one or whatever, a depression can actually be not too bad of a time. Now, obviously, it sucks for those who lose their job, etc. But what makes high inflation worse than a depression is that even if you still have your job, or even if you still are running a business that's doing okay, in a period of high inflation, you can have money and still not be able to buy stuff. You can still be working and getting paid and not be able to afford your wants, or in dire cases, even your necessities. And for extreme examples of how high inflation destroys a society, you can look at things like the famous Weimar Germany 1920s hyperinflation. You can look at the more recent hyperinflations in Zimbabwe, former Yugoslavia, I think a few other of the Eastern Bloc countries too, although off the top of my head I can't name which ones. Several Latin American countries that in recent years have experienced hyperinflation or something close to it. It really messes up an economy in ways that are even more severe and corrosive. And not just the economy, but the civilization itself, the society. In ways that are far worse than just the damage done by a regular old standard depression. So one of the problems that high inflation creates for a society is unpredictability. Now, there's always an element of unpredictability in any economy, but when you have a relatively stable currency, such as, you know, precious metals or anything that tends to be pretty stable in value over the long term, you might not be able to perfectly forecast everything, but at least you can take the basic value of the currency as a given, as a non-variable component to your plans, your ideas. So if you're a producer, an employer, a consumer, whatever, and you have stable money, you can plan, right? You can, you know, predict what things roughly are going to cost because things are kind of stable. But if you have money that's constantly losing its value, especially at a very rapid rate, it becomes difficult to impossible to forecast, plan, or predict with any accuracy. So people have no clue what something is going to cost next month or next year, other than they can probably reasonably assume it'll cost more than whatever it does right now. But beyond that, it's difficult to say, whereas on a real gold standard or any other system that provides a lot of stability, you can do that. And that makes it a hell of a lot easier to run a business, or even if you're not a business owner or an entrepreneur, it makes it a lot easier if you're just an average Joe, employee slash consumer, you can make better financial plans. If you know you need to buy something, and you have stable money, you can plan and save up and then buy it next year, and it won't go up drastically in price, or at least it probably won't. Another problem, and this is one that creates, I think, societal, you might even say civilizational, corrosive effects. I mean, it even messes up with people's, like, personal morality, I think. And again, people a lot more brilliant as specialists on this topic think so as well. I'll try to put at least one book in the show notes on the German hyperinflation of the 1920s, even though that's not what I'm talking about here, but to illustrate the general principle that high inflation doesn't just mess up the economy, it messes up society and ultimately civilization in a place that experiences it. So one of these really corrosive effects it has on society is it creates high time preference in people. In other words, it incentivizes people to adopt, if they don't already have it already, a instant gratification, high time preference sort of a mindset of, if I want something, I'm going to get it now, even if I have to go into debt or whatever, because the thing's going to keep going up in cost, so I want to spend my money as soon as I get it, and if there's something I want, I'm better off buying it now, even if it's on credit, on debt, than I am to save up. Because if I save up, by the time I save up, the money I've been saving loses its value as I'm saving it. And so it actually, under a highly inflationary monetary system, it pays in a way. In other words, you're incentivized to try to spend as soon as possible. And it disincentivizes people to really save, to be frugal, to work hard and save for the future, to save up to buy something rather than to buy it now on credit. And this has ripple effects even in the parts of society that don't immediately seem economic. Because just think about it. If a society is suddenly incentivized through high inflation to have an instant gratification mindset, to have the notion of, I want it now, to start thinking always in terms of high time preference, right? Think of all that that prevents in terms of the things that normally make a society, you know, happy, tranquil, safe, prosperous, a society that would make a society get wealthier and more advanced technologically over time, right? Because if you're disincentivized from saving, then it's hard to have as much capital accumulation, right? Investment in things like long-term R&D projects and those sorts of things that cause a society to become more productive and therefore more wealthy in the true sense of the word as time goes on. Furthermore, the more that you nudge people in the direction of high time preference, the more you're going to tend to have dishonesty and criminality. And I think you can see this if you look at any society that has very high inflation. You tend to see very significant spikes in criminality of all types, not just, you know, people stealing because they're having a hard time making ends meet, but increased criminality and sort of social problems. You find things like out of wedlock childbirths tend to go up during periods of higher inflation, at least in the information I've seen. Things like that that are not good in the long term for society in terms of things being stable and cohesive and most people being relatively honest and not being criminals. And by the way, there's some good economic work that shows that people being able to trust each other is a huge enabler of more productive economic activity and therefore of general prosperity. Countries that rate highly in terms of social trust among their citizens also tend to be the most prosperous in many measures. So just in general, by degrading a society's time preference, by making them incentivized to be instant gratification, I want it now, high time preference, then you are incentivizing all sorts of other attitudes and behaviors that will only intensify as time goes on and these conditions continue and even worsen. And in addition, high inflation swindles a lot of people who you might think from a moral perspective don't deserve to be swindled and deserve to do okay because in years gone by they've quote-unquote done the right thing. So for example, someone who has large savings ends up getting screwed by high inflation because even if their savings account is paying a couple points of interest, which is higher than savings accounts pay today with artificially low interest rates. But even in days gone by where interest rates were not held down quite as artificially low as they are today, you might be making a couple points on your savings account and think, all right, I'm doing okay. And then here comes hyperinflation that wipes out, you know, 20, 30% of the value of every dollar in a year in your savings account. And now suddenly you're not making any profit. You're losing, you know, negative however many percent over whatever the interest rate was in your savings account, right? So people who have worked hard and been frugal and been self-disciplined and lived below their means and put some away a little bit at a time for years, if high inflation comes along, bam, they get kicked in the groin economically. Also, anybody on fixed incomes of any type, anybody who earns a set amount of money, you know, from an annuity or a pension or whatever, oftentimes, again, maybe not always, but in a lot of cases, these are people who worked very hard, who paid into some pension or whatever over the course of their working life, and then they retire and they're getting, you know, some sort of fixed amount every month or what have you, and then suddenly high inflation comes in and they're still getting the same amount of dollars every month, but it has a hell of a lot less purchasing power, so they're impoverished. Same thing, even someone who's working for a wage or a salary, but if it's a wage or a salary that only is adjusted once a year, right? Like every contract year. For example, my job, teaching college history, I every year, you know, have a contract that says what my salary is going to be for that year. Now, if, I don't know, a couple months into the contract year, massive hyperinflation hits, my salary is not going to be adjusted. And so I'm going to be impoverished until my next contract year comes, and then only if in it there's a raise, which often these days there's not. There's been a lot of salary freezes lately. So even people who are not on fixed incomes, but who only have their salary or their wages adjusted at most annually, if that, those people will be impoverished. And who tends to do well from high inflation, or at least does better than everyone else? It tends to be anyone who's tight to the state's fiscal apparatus in a big way. Not people on, like, you know, little welfare programs or Social Security. Those people, it's very easy to manipulate things so that they don't get an inflation adjustment, or at least not one that's significant enough for those people. But the big boys, right? The people, the corporate welfare queens, right? The Wall Street banks who get the new money first before it pushes prices up throughout the economy, they disproportionately profit. Military contractors, any kind of contractors, and any major corporation that gets welfare, right? Giant agribusinesses that get billions of dollars, they will generally see their payments get adjusted to keep up with, or oftentimes even keep ahead of, the inflation rate. So when there's hyperinflation, not only is wealth ruined in a lot of ways in the economy, but wealth is redistributed. Wealth is redistributed from people who are, in many ways, the most honest, hardworking, frugal, disciplined people, and their purchasing power gets redistributed to speculators, banksters, military contractors, big agribusinesses, and other entities that get massive amounts of government money. So those are just some of the things going on, and these are the things that are unleashed in the 1970s. You can see, you know, spikes in violent crime and so on in the late 60s and into the 70s. And part of this, I think, is attributable to the Vietnam War. A prolonged bloody war like that always has a corrosive effect on people's morals and on violent crime rates and everything from child abuse to alcoholism and so on and mental illness. But part of it also, I believe, is the social effects of the high inflation that ran from the late 60s through all the way into the early 80s. So as this inflation continued to rise during these years, what were the supposed leaders, the presidentes, what were they doing to try and deal with the situation? Were they doing anything to stabilize the dollar by reining in spending and money printing? Were they doing anything to reestablish a link to some sort of stable commodity to stabilize the value of the dollar? No, because all that stuff would require short-term pain in the form of spending cuts and so on. Instead, for the most part, they came up with a bunch of nonsense things that either did absolutely nothing or at most treated the symptoms rather than the cause for many years. So, of course, you know, the Watergate scandal took down Nixon in 1974. He was replaced by Gerald Ford as president, who served until 1977. And Ford at least acknowledged that inflation was a big problem. He declared it, in his words, domestic enemy number one, and actually started wearing and issuing to his administration buttons that said WIN in all capital letters, W-I-N, which was supposed to stand for Whip Inflation Now. And this became something of a joke, actually. I mean, it revealed that at least they thought it was a problem, but, I mean, what are you going to do? You know, use buttons and PR campaigns to stop inflation? I mean, that's the equivalent. Like, there's only one way to stop inflation, and that's to stop the monetary creation and all, you know, that goes with it, the artificially low interest rates and so on. That's the only way to stop inflation, is to stop what's causing inflation. The notion that you can just sort of PR it away, that would be like if you had cancer and you're like, well, I don't want to do chemo or surgery or whatever, because even though that might fix it, it'll make me uncomfortable in the short term. So instead, I'm going to wear a button that says cancer sucks or fuck cancer, right? And I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to get my family members to wear t-shirts saying down with cancer, and then it'll, you know, it'll just go away, right? And that reminds me of the underpants gnomes in South Park, right? Step one, collect underpants. Step two, step three, profit, right? It's kind of like that. Step one, wear Whip Inflation Now buttons. Step two, dot, dot, dot. Step three, inflation goes down. Now, Ford did take some kind of measures to try and slow down, you know, spending and monetary creation. He did take some substantive measures. I'll throw him a bone there. However, he was not president long enough to really keep these going. Because here's what happens. When you have an economy that's become addicted to low interest rates and constant monetary creation, you have an economy that if you ever start to slow down or cut off the spigot of easy credit and easy money, is going to have withdrawal. It's just like someone addicted to a drug. When you stop the flow of heroin or whatever the hell they're addicted to, they're going to go through withdrawal. They're going to not feel very good for a while, right? And they're going to think, oh man, this sucks. I should have never quit. Now, of course, if they can, you know, one way or another, power through that and make it out the far end of withdrawal, eventually they are going to be better and healthier and feel better if they can make it. But during the period in which they're going through withdrawal, it sucks. And it's the same thing when you're trying to get an economy that's addicted to easy money off of easy money. It's going to cause some amount of discomfort. It's going to cause recessions and, you know, economic slowdowns and unemployment in the short term. And it's very analogous to, I believe, quitting some drug, right? The drug made you feel good at the time, but it was destroying your real health. Inflation can cause short-term economic booms, but they're not sustainable, they're not real, and under the surface, while the inflation is making it seem like everything's okay for a little while, it's actually eating away at the economy from within, just like drugs are, you know, destroying your health, even though you might feel good at the time. And just like, you know, quitting drugs, your body is actually fixing itself during the period where you feel terrible. Well, when you quit the easy money addiction, an economy is going to feel terrible for a while, but that's because the economy is actually, you know, fixing itself. It's reallocating resources to reflect a less inflationary reality. So Ford's actions that he did take on inflation, the substantive actions, did cause a recession during his presidency, which may have been one of the things, in addition to his pardoning of Nixon, that made him unpopular enough to not get reelected in 1976. So Ford wasn't able to keep up his efforts to try and get inflation under control. So we don't know whether he would have been able to do it in the long term. There was a slowing down of the inflation rate a little bit during the Ford presidency. Then, of course, Ford was followed into the White House by Jimmy Carter, elected in 1976, served as president from 1977 until early 1981, when, of course, he was replaced by Ronald Reagan. And Jimmy Carter began his presidency basically following the so-called New Economist orthodoxy, the neo-Keynesian ideas that had been followed by most of his immediate predecessors. Maybe to a lesser extent by Ford, but, you know, the things I talked about in part four of my coverage of the history of the U.S. dollar, the policies that were followed by John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and for the most part by Richard Nixon, the Keynesian ideas of using inflation, trying to use inflation in a controlled strategic way to lower unemployment, which eventually got out of hand and you ended up with stagflation by the early 70s, right? The combination of stagnant economy, high unemployment, and high inflation, which the Keynesian economists had said was basically impossible. They believed there was a constant inverse relationship between inflation and unemployment, the so-called Phillips curve. The idea was if you increased inflation, it would automatically decrease unemployment and vice versa. But the 70s proved that the Phillips curve doesn't always work out that way, that in fact, you can have high inflation and high unemployment, low economic growth all at the same time, stagflation. Well, Carter began his presidency basically following the same Keynesian playbook of trying to stimulate the economy and lower the unemployment rate through easy money and government spending. And the result was that inflation, which had gone down a little bit during the Ford years, ended up jumping back up in much of the first part of the Carter presidency. In fact, by 1980, the inflation rate was running at 15% annually, and in reality, it was probably higher than that. That's the official government numbers, which, for various reasons, you should never quite trust. And I think to his credit, Jimmy Carter realized this and did start to change his approach in the latter part of his presidency, like the last, you know, year and a half or so. He reversed a lot of the Keynesian orthodoxy, and he did so by appointing a new Federal Reserve chairman in 1979, and that was Paul Volcker. So before I continue and tell you what Paul Volcker did to at least significantly slow down the inflation, let me just give you some numbers so you get an understanding of what this inflation was really doing. Now, keep in mind, I'm driving as I record this, so you know, when I do a podcast in the car, it has to be something where I can do pretty minimal notes. So it can't be one of my super heavy detail history narratives. It can be stuff where I've got like a couple basic notes jotted down and I tape it to my steering wheel or tape it to my console of my car. And obviously I'm driving. Now, luckily for me, most of the time, most of my commute is through rural areas, you know, farms and a little bit of woods and stuff. So most of it is not heavy traffic, other than the part right by my house and the part right by where I work. And that actually means I can read a tiny bit of notes here and there, you know, for facts and figures or the occasional quote off my little notes as I'm driving, and do it safely. You know, if I had a commute in crazy, you know, jam-packed, gridlocked interstate traffic in a metropolitan area, I absolutely, believe me, would not be glancing at notes even occasionally as I was driving. But thankfully, one of the nice things about, you know, it sucks having a 40-minute commute. On the other hand, I don't want to live near where I work, so I prefer living where I live. And at least with a 40-minute commute that I've got, it is a quiet country drive for the most part. But anyway, and I also understand you're listening, and when you're listening to somebody, you don't want to get too much in the way of figures and all that stuff because it's easy to get lost. So I'll just give you a few basics to give you some real-world handle on what's going on during the period of the so-called Great Inflation, of the period from the 60s through the early 80s. So in 1960, the average annual income of an American household was about $5,300. In 1970, the average annual income of an American household was about $9,300. So in a decade, the average annual income increased by 75%, measured in dollars. That's the key, right? If the dollar's value had been constant during that decade, that would have meant that, you know, Americans were doing really well. But of course, you have to look at what's happening to the purchasing power of the dollar during that same decade. So from 1960 to 1970, the average price of a home went from $12,000 in 1960 to $23,000 in 1970. In other words, during a period where the average American's income went up 75%, the price of a home went up 92%. So went up quite a bit faster than income. During that same period, 1960 to 1970, the price of gas went from 25 cents a gallon to 36 cents a gallon. Now, I know from today's perspective, 36 cents a gallon is like insane, right? And you're thinking, who the hell could possibly complain about that in 1970? But remember, the starting point was 25 cents a gallon. So from 25 to 36 cents, that's about a 44% increase. So the gas prices in the 60s didn't go up that bad. It went up slower than the price of homes by far, and even went up slower than the average income. So from what happened during the next decade, from 1970 to 1980, remember, 1970 average income is $9,300 a year. 1980, it is $19,000 a year. The average annual income from 1970 to 1980 went from $9,300 to $19,000. In other words, it more than doubled. But what happened to the average home price during that same decade? From 1970, the average home price was $23,000. It went in 1980 up to $69,000. So that's, what, about a tripling? It is exactly a tripling, 23,000 to 69,000. So in the same period, your income more or less doubled, the price of a house more or less tripled, right? And what happened to a gallon of gas? Well, in 1970, remember, gallon of gas, 36 cents. 1980, gallon of gas, $1.19. Again, don't let the fact that $1.19 for gas today sounds great disguise the fact that from 1970 to 1980, the price of a gallon of gas more than tripled. So your dollars of income don't quite double. Price of a house triples, price of gas more than triples. That's what's happening. Here's a few random prices of some random items taken at various years that I looked up just to give you a handle on things. In 1968, a McDonald's hamburger cost 18 cents. In 1974, same burger cost 30 cents. In 1979, same burger cost 38 cents. 1984, same burger cost 50 cents. 18-ounce box of cornflakes, 1962, sold for 27 cents. 1968, sold for 39 cents. 1976, sold for 69 cents. 1981, sold for $1.12. So it increased by, what, a factor of almost five in price from 1962 to 1981. Hershey bar, standard Hershey bar. 1960, the bar was 1 ounce. It cost a nickel. In 1968, the bar still cost a nickel, but they chopped it down to 3/4 of an ounce, which, by the way, is something that commonly happens during periods of high inflation. There's, you know, not only are prices jacked up to reflect the decreased purchasing power of money, but oftentimes the size and or the quality of the item is reduced in order to make up the cost differential. In 1973, they upped the size of the bar a little bit, up to 1.2 ounces, but they also doubled the price to 10 cents. And in 1978, it was still 1.2 ounces, and it was up to 25 cents. So the price of a Hershey bar more than doubled just from 1973 to 1978, which shows you that's the period of some of the higher inflation of the 1970s. So anyway, back to Paul Volcker. By the way, Paul Volcker was a very much a plugged-in economist of the power elite, in particular the Rockefeller gang of the American power elite. He was their boy. And it's not surprising that Jimmy Carter would nominate a Rockefeller-affiliated power elite economist to be the Fed chairman, because Jimmy Carter had a lot of Rockefeller stuff behind him. He had a lot of Rockefeller connections. It's basically David Rockefeller, the Trilateral Commission, and a few other business interests, also one way or another affiliated with the Rockefeller clique, that not only helped Jimmy Carter become governor of Georgia, but then really helped him to come out of nowhere. I mean, anytime a political candidate comes from obscurity to major party nominee and then president in a very short amount of time, to me that should be a red flag. That should make you suspicious that there's some amount of behind-the-scenes power elite machinations going on. That the powers that be have, for whatever reason, decided that this little-known politician, whether he be a one-term governor from Georgia or a senator from Illinois who's only served like half a term, suddenly becomes a major contender and then president. That should let you know that the people behind the scenes, the real big money boys, have chosen that person as a sock puppet, as a good front man for the time being. So that's the case with Jimmy Carter and the Rockefellers. I mean, he's an obscure one-term governor of Georgia that almost nobody had heard of, and he gets invited to the Trilateral Commission, one of the most elite, exclusive organizations. It's much more elite and exclusive than the Council on Foreign Relations. And why the hell are they bringing this guy in? And they said at the time, they were like, oh yeah, we want to hear his views on foreign policy, right? So exactly what views on foreign policy is a one-term governor of Georgia going to have? Anyway, I will give credit to Paul Volcker in this regard. Now, I'm entirely opposed to the existence of the Federal Reserve and anything even resembling it, for the record, but I will say this about Paul Volcker. I will give him his due. Paul Volcker is probably almost the only, if not the only, Federal Reserve chairman in the history of that sorry institution who ever did anything substantive on the part of the Federal Reserve's mandate having to do with trying to preserve the purchasing power of the dollar. And even there, he did not completely eliminate inflation. He just brought it down to what was considered by the powers that be, including him, manageable levels that were not immediately damaging to the economy. And it shows you how bad, I mean, the Rockefellers, the sort of Rockefeller gang, and I don't just mean the Rockefeller family, but like all the other power elite families that kind of socialize and intermarry with them and do business with them, they were one of the two main blocks behind the creation of the Fed in the first place. The other, of course, being the J.P. Morgan gang. And the fact that even the Rockefellers by the late 70s were like, wow, we have to restore some of the value of the dollar, this is getting out of hand, shows you, A, that things were really bad, and B, sometimes the power elite can become victims of their own policies when they go too far. And that they're not always as in control as they think they are and as they want you to think they are. That's the thing. There's these powerful people like the Rockefellers and many others who are pulling strings and, you know, nudging the economy various ways. And they certainly are playing the system, and very often they're playing the system very successfully to enrich themselves at other people's expense. Don't get me wrong. But that sometimes things can even get out of control of their hands. And I think this was a case of it, where they were pursuing this easy money policy, these Keynesian policies, these low interest rates policies for a bunch of years and benefiting from them for many years. And then suddenly it went too far, it got out of control, and Volcker had to be the hatchet man. Volcker had to be the guy to come in and, at least for the time being, it didn't last that long, but for the time being, rein in the low interest rates, the Keynesian policies, and get inflation back to a lower level where people at least weren't hurt by it as much in the near term. It didn't notice it as much on a day-to-day basis. I mean, if, don't get me wrong, if price inflation is running 2-3% a year, you are still being robbed. But it's a lot less noticeable to everybody than if price inflation is running 15% a year, or even higher than that. So Paul Volcker was appointed to head the Federal Reserve in 1979, and he would end up serving 2 4-year terms in that job. He was reappointed by Ronald Reagan in 1983 and served as Federal Reserve Chairman until 1987. And Volcker was single-mindedly committed to stopping, by which, again, they didn't really mean stopping. In their terms, they called it stopping inflation. They really meant just bringing it down to a much lower level. Holding the inflation, staunching the bleeding of the value of the dollar, even if it caused recession. Volcker, finally, was a Federal Reserve chairman who understood that stopping inflation would cause a recession, and he was willing to take that bitter pill. You know, so he's like the guy who, again, is addicted to a substance, is ready to quit, and says, I understand it's going to be uncomfortable, but we're going to just, you know, grit our teeth and get through it to come out the other end in a better position. So by jacking up interest rates, Volcker is looking to put the brakes on the growth of the money supply. And the author of the book, The Great Inflation, which is one of the books on this topic that I will put an Amazon affiliate link to in the show notes, I forget his first name, and I don't have it in front of me. His last name is Samuelson. I can't remember his first name. But anyway, author Samuelson of The Great Inflation said, and I did jot this quote down in my notes, quote, Volcker's approach was not subtle. The Federal Reserve bludgeoned the economy until inflation subsided. And it did cause a nasty, sharp recession in sort of 1979-1980. And by 1980, the recession was predictably causing Jimmy Carter's popularity to suffer. And Jimmy Carter began to have second thoughts about Volcker's approach, that maybe this was doing more harm than good, and maybe it was better to just learn to live with the inflation and not have the nasty recession. And it's, I think, pretty certain that it was this recession in 1980 that combined with the spectacle of the Iran hostage crisis were the two main things that hurt Jimmy Carter's popularity enough to pave the way for Ronald Reagan to come in and defeat him in the 1980 election. So just to give you an example of the effect Volcker's policies had on economic activity in the United States, by 1981, 30-year fixed mortgage rates for people with good credit were running 15% or even higher. And these high interest rates did cause a nasty recession that continued for several years into the early part of Reagan's term. By the end of 1982, for example, unemployment was reaching 11%. And again, that's government unemployment numbers. The real number is probably even worse than that. So what happened to the dollar under Reagan? Well, first off, remember I mentioned before in the 1960s, silver was taken out of the dollar coins, the half-dollar coins, and also the quarters and dimes. Well, in 1982, most of the copper was taken out of the penny. Again, the effects of inflation are so bad that not only do you have to take the silver out of the silver coins, you even have to take the friggin' copper out of the penny. That's how much you're destroying the value of the money itself. So ever since 1982, pennies have been, I think if I remember right, 95% zinc with a thin couple percent, you know, or 5%, I guess, copper coating on it. So pennies haven't even been copper for over 30 years. That's how much the government has screwed up the money. So what happened overall to the economy and the dollar under Reagan? Well, Reagan made fighting inflation one of his top priorities, and to his credit, as far as getting inflation under control, he backed Volcker. And he backed Volcker continuing his inflation bludgeoning policies despite the understandable unpopularity of the recession and the unemployment. And, you know, if you don't remember it personally, if like me, you were too young to really know what was going on, in the first couple of years of Reagan's presidency, there was a nasty recession with lots of unemployment. And Reagan was very unpopular. And what saved his popularity was probably getting shot by, what's his name, John Hinckley. That probably saved him from having, like, some of the lowest popularity ever in his first term. And then the fact that by about 83, 84, the economy was recovering pretty well. Those are the two factors that probably helped his popularity enough that, combined with how crappy of a candidate Walter Mondale was in 84, caused Reagan to win a huge landslide re-election. Won 49 states, every state except for Minnesota, the home state of Walter Mondale. So that means that Reagan even won in such typically Democratic strongholds as the West Coast and the Northeast and so on. But in the first few years, when Volcker was still bludgeoning the inflation rate down, even many of Reagan's own administration urged him to fire Paul Volcker and to ease up on the money and credit to lower the interest rates. But Reagan stayed the course. And even though the media and seemed like at the time most politicians of both parties were brutal in their criticisms of Reagan and also of Volcker, and just like could not understand why Reagan was backing Volcker continuing to do what he was doing. And, you know, Reagan kept Volcker in there and backed him up, even though Volcker was a Democrat. I mean, he's considered kind of a conservative Democrat, but still, he was a Democrat. That's why he was appointed by Carter in the first place. But as far as getting the inflation rate down, it did work. By 1983, inflation was down to about 3.8%, which, you know, still I would consider robbery and swindling, but I suppose if you're to be swindled, it's better to be swindled at 3.8% than by 15%, right? I mean, rather not be swindled at all, but... And the economy by 83 did begin to recover, and unemployment began falling. It was still over 10% in early 1983, but by 1984, which was when Reagan ran for re-election, it was down around 7% and continued falling for much of the 80s. And, you know, much of the rest of the 80s was, for many people, a much better economic time than the 70s or the early 80s had been. And modern-day mainstream typical standard conservatives, who, of course, are Reagan worshippers, and I am not a Reagan worshipper. I'm very much... I consider his anti-government rhetoric largely an empty scam, and just check out my episode I did a while back on the Reagan myth for a little bit of information on that. But anyway, conservatives always want to give Reagan credit for the good economy of the kind of mid to late 1980s and tack it all up to his tax cuts. And while certainly cutting taxes doesn't hurt the economy, it's, to me, way too simplistic to say it was all just that one thing that he did a little bit of tax cuts. And by the way, his tax cuts are very overrated. Again, check out my episode on that for some more information. I would argue that while tax cuts certainly are good for an economy, that getting high inflation down to a low level is actually much more important to getting the economy in better shape than is cutting some tax rates here and there. And I think that's the real secret to Reagan's popularity. And you know how you can tell that something's no longer a serious problem for people is that they don't mention it. If you look at polls in general from like the 70s and even into the early part of the 80s, and you look at polls where they ask Americans like to name their biggest concerns or their biggest problems in like the political arena, and for much of the 70s and into the very early 80s, inflation was always like at the top or very close to the top. And by the mid 80s, inflation wasn't even on the list. I mean, whether some rich dude down the road from you pays 40% or 30% in his income tax rate doesn't affect most people's personal economy as much as whether groceries are going up by 20% a year or 3% a year. Now, when Volcker got inflation down into like the 3% range, he finally relaxed monetary policy, interest rates began coming down, and unfortunately, Reagan then appointed Alan Greenspan to head the Fed in 1987, and Alan Greenspan was not nearly as disciplined on trying to hold down inflation as Volcker had been. And Alan Greenspan, you know, for a lot of the 90s and aughts, he was Fed chairman for what, like 20 years? I forget exactly. But Alan Greenspan did a hell of a lot of interest rate cutting and, you know, essentially dumping of easy money and credit into the economy and holding interest rates way down for a long time. And aside from the fact that it led eventually to gas prices being, what, like $4 or something in the early aughts, it also kicked off multiple bubbles in the late 90s and in the aughts. So there you go. Now, I just want to talk a bit about the term petrodollar, because that's really what the dollar has been since the end of Bretton Woods and the cutting of the last link to gold. What happened is the petrodollar refers to the U.S. dollar having more value than other countries' currencies because of its utility in buying and selling oil internationally. And in a way, the petrodollar kind of started immediately after World War II anyway, just because, thanks to the Bretton Woods system and the economic might of the United States in the post-war years, it was already kind of naturally the currency that major oil-producing countries priced and sold their oil in. But it becomes even more important once you cut that last tie to gold, if you're going to have any sort of a backstop to have it be the most important commodity in modern economies, which is petroleum. So Richard Nixon, I think, I forget the exact year, it was right around, give or take a year, when he ended Bretton Woods and cut the tie to gold. Richard Nixon made a deal with the Saudi Arabian monarchy to promise only to price and buy and sell their oil in U.S. dollars. And then similar deals were made with most of the top oil producing countries. And so what happened was the fact that the dollar stayed the world currency for all international buying and selling of petroleum gave the dollar a little bit more continued value than it might have otherwise had. In other words, had some other country, such as, I don't know, Japan, let's say, had they gone as crazy with money creation and low interest rates as the United States had in the 1970s, they would have experienced even worse price inflation than the United States did, because there wouldn't have been the demand internationally for other countries to get yen in order to buy petroleum. The fact that the United States dollar is the currency in which oil is priced and bought and sold internationally gives it additional value and means that many other countries are going to soak up excess dollars when the Fed creates, you know, more money. They're gonna in a way soak up some of the inflation internationally. And basically it goes like this: with this dollar as the money for oil, if Germany wants to buy oil from Saudi Arabia, they won't use, in the old days, marks, or, you know, more recently, euros. And they also won't use the Saudi Arabian dinar, or whatever the hell the Saudi Arabian currency is. Instead, Germany must acquire dollars and then use those dollars to pay Saudi Arabia for the oil. This means that because all the countries looking to purchase oil have to first acquire dollars, there is a lot of additional artificial demand internationally for U.S. dollars, which backstops its value more than it otherwise would. I've heard, I think it was Jack Spirko, use this analogy, and I think it's a good one, to help understand if you're having trouble wrapping your mind around this notion. It would be like, let's say, in the United States, let's say there was some sort of rule that said when business is done between the various states of the United States, it must be conducted in oranges. Oranges must be the currency, right? So in other words, if, for example, let's say Washington State wanted to purchase cattle, you know, beef, from Texas, they couldn't just trade apples from Washington State for Texas's beef. They would have to first take the intermediate step of Washington State sells its apples to either Florida or California for oranges, and then gives those oranges to Texas in exchange for the cattle, right? Now, what does this do economically for the states that produce oranges, which, as far as I know, it's basically California and Florida, at least as far as large numbers of oranges. What does it do for California and Florida? Well, it gives them a major leg up against all the other states, right? Because they produce, they have a monopoly on the thing that every other state needs to buy stuff, right? And that's the case with the dollar in regards to the most important commodity in modern day economies, which is petroleum. By the way, that's one of the things that prevents inflation from getting as bad as it otherwise might have in the United States in the 70s. The other is interestingly, the rise of international cocaine cartels in the 70s and early 80s. And these guys soaked up billions of dollars, of U.S. dollars, and at least had a temporary effect of absorbing some of the inflation as well. It probably wasn't as big of a deal as the whole petrodollar thing, but, man, it still did have some effect, you know, hoovering billions of dollars out of circulation for the time being to go into the vaults of drug lords. So what has happened in the years of the petrodollar since the 70s is that America has still been able to export some of the consequences of its monetary policies. We certainly have had some inflation, and including some periods of some pretty bad inflation for the past 30, 40 years. But it's not as bad as it would have been had there not been this petrodollar arrangement. Now, I think I said earlier in this episode, you can delay the impact of economic reality, of transgressing economic laws. You can delay that, but you can't prevent it forever. And in general, the longer you delay it, the more it's going to hit harder when it does snap back to reality. Think about it like a rubber band, right? The longer you pull it, when it does snap, the harder it's going to snap. So the United States has been able to get away with crazier amounts of money creation than any other country ever could because of this artificial situation of having the dollar be the reserve currency of the world, especially for petroleum. But what happens if some major petroleum producing countries start to say, we're no longer going to accept dollars, or we will accept dollars, but we're also going to accept a bunch of other things too as payment for our oil, right? I mean, what happens if some of the major oil-producing countries in the world start saying, hey, we don't trust the U.S. dollar anymore. We're only going to accept euros, Or maybe they don't trust the euro with good reason. And maybe they say, we're only going to take gold for oil. Or we're only going to take whatever, some other valuable commodity. Or Bitcoin, right? Who the hell knows? And let's say that starts a domino effect of other oil-producing countries also jumping ship and saying either we'll take other stuff in addition to the dollar or we don't want the U.S. dollar at all, we want XYZ, right? That is one of the things that I think could cause a really quick devaluation of the dollar in a dramatic way. I'm not saying I think absolutely it's gonna happen. I'm saying logically it definitely could. And the dollar has to decline in value. It has to, more dramatically than it has, at some point. That I think is unavoidable. It's just a question of exactly when. Will it happen next year? Will it happen in 5 years? Will it happen longer away than that? That, you know, I don't know. And anyone who says for sure they absolutely know is, in my opinion, full of shit. But mathematically, there has to be a decline in the value of the dollar that's more dramatic than anything we've seen in recent times. It has to. And I think the whole petrodollar situation is the most likely corner, the most likely kind of domino that could fall and cause a massive decrease in the value of the dollar, and therefore a massive jump in the price of everything for Americans. If the rest of the world no longer wants to abide by this arbitrary notion of the dollar as the magical reserve currency for buying oil. And by the way, if there is major devaluation of the dollar, the Federal Reserve can't use the tool that Paul Volcker used back in the day to get inflation under control. They can't. Because if the Fed, even if they wanted to, and I doubt the current people at the Fed really would even want to, unless, you know, it was the only way to avoid a total economic collapse in their view. But even if they wanted to jack up interest rates to fight inflation, the Fed can't do it the way they did back in Volcker's day. And the reason is because the national debt is so much bigger that if they jacked up interest rates now, it would overnight bankrupt in a visible sense. I mean, yeah, I agree, those who say the U.S. government basically is bankrupt, it's just, you know, hasn't quite hit yet. The consequences haven't hit yet, but, you know, the math is there. But, you know, could really literally bankrupt the United States government in a way that everybody sees if they jacked up interest rates now, because the national debt is so much bigger. If interest rates go up, they can't afford it. Payments on the interest, you know, servicing the national debt is a much larger percentage of the budget today than it was in, say, 1979. And again, I'm driving, so I don't have the figures in front of me, but it is a bigger portion of the federal budget. And the total debt is so much bigger. In 1980, the U.S. national debt was still under $1 trillion. It was $900 billion. The entire official U.S. national debt was about $900 billion in 1980. Seems quaint by today's standards, right? Seems like a rounding error. I mean, the entire national debt at that time, think about it, was about as much as the Wall Street bailout of 2008. Today, the official debt is 18 trillion something. And of course, as many of you probably know, the real national debt is actually much bigger than that. That's only kind of the, you know, some of the categories. It doesn't count unfunded liabilities and a bunch of other things. But I'll put a link in the show notes to the good old U.S. debt clock in case you've never looked at that. It's quite amusing. I mean, those numbers are getting into ridiculous land of they will never be paid off because they can't be. It's too much. The national debt can never be paid off because math is real, is how I look at it. So even looking at the official debt numbers, it's what, like 25 times as much national debt as there was in 1980? You can't jack up interest rates and keep paying on that. So even the way the Fed was able to weasel out of the effects of high inflation back in Volcker's day, they couldn't do that now. That tool is not available to them. So how they will handle it, I do not know. I do not know. When the chickens come home to roost and the bankruptcy, which has really been there for many years, is finally revealed for even idiots to see, how will they handle it? I don't know, but I doubt it will end pretty. That's all I can say about specific predictions there. So, you know, how can you handle it? I think the sort of basic, be prepared, diversify. Do not put all of your you know, savings and investment and all that stuff in any one basket, including even precious metals. I think you should have some precious metals. I sure as hell have some. But people who say like, oh yeah, throw literally every dollar you have into silver or whatever, I think is crazy. I think you should have some gold, some silver. Exact percentages, you have to figure out what works for you and how much you're willing to put into that, how much you're willing to put into other things and so on. But you definitely want to be diversified in your investments. And I don't just mean in terms of stocks, bonds, commodities, whatever else you might have. I mean investments across the board, including kind of survivalist prepper type stuff. And also, I mean your human capital. Invest in your human capital. Because if shit gets really rough economically, like, you know, worse than it is when, like, if all of America starts to look like Detroit, right? It's not going to be fun and happy for anybody to live through that. But the more skills you have, the more tools you have in your toolbox, the more stuff you know how to do. And I don't just mean hard skills, although I do mean hard skills, but I mean soft skills too, right? And this gets back into scholar warrior type stuff, the whole scholar warrior concept, like I talked about a few episodes back. Maximizing individual versatility. The more things you know how to do, the more adaptable you are, the more versatile of a human being you are as an individual. And I think it's just absolutely logical, makes perfect sense, that the more versatile you are, the more you can weather economic hardship and bad economic times. And I don't just mean the ability to make stuff, to grow food, to fix things, maybe even to build certain things. That's all great stuff. And I'm absolutely, you know, saying that those are helpful things to have. But I would also add in there, don't overlook skills that may not produce things that are tangible, but that still people will value and will be willing to reward you for, even if times are tough. And I'll just give you one example of a skill that people might not think of in this sort of context that might actually be able to help you, and that is musical ability. You might think I'm crazy, but my dad got through some bad economic times in the late 70s, early 80s, in part because he could sing and play guitar, and he's one of these guys, he could just, you know, him and an acoustic guitar could entertain a bar full of people for hours. He's really good at that kind of stuff. And so he was able to, when he lost a job and had some other problems during this tough economic period I was just talking about, he was able to get by in part because he could pick up some gigs, you know, playing in bars and making decent money for you know, one night's work. And if you look back at, like, during the Great Depression, you might not have always been able to make a huge living, but if you were between, like, real day jobs, you could definitely help get yourself by if you could, you know, sing and play music in bars and make a few bucks. So I don't just mean the ability to grow food and to fix stuff and whatever, that's all great, but keep in mind that other skills could come in handy as well. You know, if you're unemployed, being able to play a gig in a bar and make $100 or even a couple $100 for 3 or 4 hours of singing and playing music and entertaining people, that could help you. And even in, like, Mad Max situations, people who can entertain and stuff like that can still get some value out of those skills. I mean, look at how many primitive cultures where basically storytellers are valued. And then think of the modern versions of being a storyteller. People value that, and people are willing to reward you for that. So anyway, those are just some of my thoughts on looking forward to the potential, not just national, but global effects of the end of the petrodollar, which has to happen. It has to happen. Again, timing, I don't know. But it has to happen at some point, the end of the petrodollar. It is a ticking time bomb. That's why I named the episode that. So it's been quite a journey, the US dollar. right? Going from a Spanish silver coin that was turned into a U.S. silver coin, that was turned into paper, that was turned into gold-backed paper, that was turned into kind of gold-backed paper, that was turned into not really backed by anything except for kind of petroleum paper. It's been a hell of a story. And I think the story of the U.S. dollar, above all else, what it illustrates is the more the state gets involved in money, the more it fucks it up and eventually destroys it. When the U.S. government was only minimally involved in money, the money was pretty solid. It was pretty sound. And then just gradually, piece by piece, they get more and more involved in money in various ways, and eventually they get to the point now where it's just a matter of time until the U.S. dollar becomes virtually worthless. The only thing, besides the whole petrodollar phenomenon, the only other thing that has been backstopping the U.S. dollar somewhat in recent years has been the fact that the other major currencies of the world are also, you know, arbitrary government currencies, not really backed by anything tangible. And so, you know, the euro and the yen and all the other big currencies have also been horribly inflated and ruined in value by their respective governments. And that's been the one thing that's been, you know, sometimes making the dollar look good. Like recently, I think the euro's been down a bit against the dollar. Makes the dollar look good by comparison. But as I think Peter Schiff or somebody like that has said, it's sort of like if two people are falling off a cliff and one of them is falling a little bit slower rate, at a little bit slower rate than the other one, it might make it appear that the guy who's falling at a slower rate is doing better, but at the end of the day, he's still going to go splat on the bottom of the cliff, even if it's a little bit later than the other guy, but they're both headed to the same place. Like I always say, if you have any comments about this particular episode, please feel free to leave them in the comment section for this episode, which again will be episode 52 of the Dangerous History Podcast, at my website, profcj.org. You can also email me questions, comments, feedback, whatever. The email address is profcj@profcj.org. Remember also, the show is on Twitter and Facebook, so you can follow things there. You know, you get updates of like new episodes and occasional random comments or updates and things like that on there as well. You can subscribe to the show in a whole bunch of different ways. I've just added a bunch of different things to the site: PowerPress and Blueberry, which are what I use for my podcasting on my website. They've just added recently some additional subscribe tools, so you'll see that there beneath the little media player and download and everything like that. For the different episodes on my website. And so you can subscribe to the show a lot of different ways. You can do Stitcher, which also has apps for Android and things like that. You can subscribe. I set up a feed burner for the show recently. There's that. There's actually a subscribe page now on my website that lists a whole bunch of different ways you can subscribe to the show. By the way, I'm happy to announce that LRN.fm, Ian Freeman's venue for a whole bunch of libertarian radio and podcast shows, LRN.fm now has the Dangerous History Podcast as one of its podcasts in their loop over there, so you can check that out. Again, LRN.fm, very, very happy to hear about, you know, getting put on there. I mean, when you look at the other shows that are on LRN.fm, there's some great shows. A lot of them are shows I've been listening to regularly for a long time, so I'm very happy and proud to be in such company there. Remember, there's lots of ways now you can support the show. One is simply to help spread the word. I appreciate that. Any potential listeners, turn them on to the show. Also consider leaving a rating or a review in iTunes and other podcast venues where the show is, to encourage other people there to give the show a shot. You can also, please, if you enjoy what I do, you like it, you want it to continue and maybe even, you know, get more of it as time goes on, hopefully, chip in financially. I'd really appreciate it. To all those who have donated or chipped in various ways recently, big, sincere, heartfelt thank you from me. You can donate via PayPal, either a one-time donation, or you can set up for a monthly recurring donation there. You go to profcj.org/donate, and you'll see a button there to make a PayPal donation. You can also donate Bitcoin. I now have a Bitcoin address up there. Anybody who's got Bitcoins burning a hole in their virtual wallet, hey, throw a little bit my way. I'm happy to absorb it from you. Bitcoin address is also on the profcj.org/donate page. And then also, remember, if you buy anything from Amazon, you can chip in a little bit to the Dangerous History Podcast by first going through one of my Amazon affiliate links. You could help out my show at no additional cost to you. So, pretty cool deal. I'm happy to even get a tiny bit. So anyway, this has been Prof. CJ. As always, doing my best to help you learn the past, understand the present, and prepare for the future.
Thanks for listening to the Dangerous History Podcast. Check us out at profcj.org. That's profcj.org.